There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
And it's not Sean Sullivan in today. It's Jeff Poore once again filling in for the great Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. The text line 343-0106, and that's also our call-in number. Lots to get to today. We got Senator Doug Jones coming up sometime this hour. I think he's dealing with important matters of the nation right now. And then in the second hour, we have Dale Jackson from Huntsville, WVNN, coming on. You also know him from Guerrilla Politics. It airs on this station at 11:30 a.m. on Saturdays. But first, when I was on Monday, we had Councilman LaVon Manzi on talking a little bit about the University of South Alabama and this effort they have underway to move the to move all their home games to an on-campus facility, an on-campus stadium, and kind of put Ladd Peoples, relegate it to kind of a high school stadium and start putting city resources and building this facility up at the University of South Alabama. And like kind of over the last few days, really digging into this and talking to people about it, you know, there's a lot of pluses for the city to do this. I understand they look at renovating Ladd Peoples as a very expensive endeavor. They see just investing in University of South Alabama would do great things for the university, for that part of the town, and it would kind of make University of South Alabama more of a college campus that would rival in Auburn or Alabama, or even, you know, some of the other institutions around the state. But just kind of digging into this, and I've given this some thought. What happens if the University of South Alabama suddenly has a monopoly on the city's biggest venue? Like, they have control of this. You want to have a concert or something in Mobile, you want to have a big event, you have to go through the University of South Alabama. And the only reason I bring this up, let's say we're in a situation like we were in 2015, where you have candidate Donald Trump and he's looking around Alabama wanting a place to come, and he looks at Mobile. Well, Mobile looks like a place, you know, it's in all these, around all these media markets. You go all the way to Florida and Mississippi and all these places, and you get broad exposure. But the University of South Alabama, which, you know, as we know with academia, says, no, we don't want a Republican, you know, right-wing guy out here on our campus. Our faculty is opposed to this. Our administration is opposed to this, and perhaps even our students are opposed to this. We're not going to allow it. We would like you to go elsewhere. Where do you go in Mobile other than the city stadium, the one where all the events are going to be, where the Senior Bowl, where the biggest, you know, it's the biggest venue in the city, where you're going to have a big draw? Where can you go in this city and not have to, you know, deal with that? And, I mean, I guess the same could be said for anywhere, even if it is a city facility, but at least then it's more in the public realm. So, I was thinking about this. What happens if something like this arises again? And do we really want to – should the city be giving up that much power and that much, you know, say in what goes on to the University of South Alabama? So this is something that I was thinking about, and, you know, these are tax dollars. We could talk about all the components of moving all this away from Ladd Peoples, what that would do for certain parts of the city and what it might do for others. But when it comes down, what is best for the city of Mobile? And I think these are some, you know, one of the questions you need to consider when you talk about these things. And here's the other problem I have with a lot of this. The pushback you get from the folks who, when you question the idea of taking games away from Ladd Peoples, and it's the right thing to do to move stuff to the University of South Alabama, it's going to be great for the economy, and all these other things. We've seen this play before in a lot of ways in Mobile. We have Hank Aaron Stadium. It kind of fell apart. It's the Bay Bears are moving to Madison, Alabama, to North Alabama. But when Hank Aaron Stadium was built, it was going to revive that sort of part of Mobile over there at Government and I-65, right? And then the other one I would really point to is probably, you know, more prevalent in all of our lives, is the idea of moving the putting the airport, Mobile's airport, way out in West Mobile where it is, like 16 miles, I think, from downtown. And that commute and the time and resources you waste getting there and back, and now this push to move it back to the Brooklee facility. But the idea when they put the airport out there was, well, it's going to be great for West Mobile. It's going to build up Airport Boulevard. It's make real estate prices go up. It's going to do all these things for the economy. But there's a cost to that. So my question is this just, are we seeing this kind of play over again when we talk about moving things from certain parts of Mobile to others in the name of economic development and whatnot? So, you know, I wrote this up for yellowhammer.com. You could news.com. You could go and read it on yellowhammernews.com and get more of a sense of it. But just talking to people, some of the feedback I got, the idea of taking power away from the city to get to the University of South Alabama rubs some people the wrong way. And I know, and I was just, the one example I would offer is what would happen if, you know, Donald Trump or a Trump-esque person came and wanted to give a speech in the city, and you have a, I would argue, a liberal institution, a place where I went to school, a place that I have gotten feedback from, you know, my professors and the administration there as being, you know, I was at the time kind of a immature conservative, but the idea was that way too conservative for us, tone it down. And I know the culture over there, and I just wonder if perhaps that would be something that would be a problem in the future, the politics of it, and just giving that much power, take away that power from the city and give it to the university. But that's what I think. I would like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 251-343-0106. FM Talk 106.5. This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan.
Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And welcome back to FM 106.5. It's Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan. Joining us on the line is Senator Doug Jones, Democrat, state of Alabama. Senator Jones, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Hey, Senator, you're in the state. You're spending some time in the state. You're doing some things with talking health care and you know, I guess, you know, I saw you did a roundtable on the opioid crisis. Other than, you know, some of these issues, what are you looking at? I know Obamacare is a really sore subject for a lot of people in this state. Are you looking at things to maybe improve it, or are looking at what needs to be done to, I guess, make it a little more sustainable?
Well, it's not just Obamacare. I mean, you know, we've talked consistently that the Affordable Care Act always needs some tweaking, some updating. You know, one of the things that we're seeing right now is that there is a real effort right now to kind of sabotage the Affordable Care Act. But I think Congress is looking for a broader situation. We've kind of moved beyond the terms Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, and we're trying to go back to looking at our health care system as a whole. And that is, you know, how can we protect people on pre-existing conditions? How are we going to be able to serve the people in rural Alabama and rural America better and keep access to good quality health care and affordable health care in our rural areas? And the thing that we started out today with a roundtable was a real health care and mental health care crisis in this country, and that's the opioid crisis. Congress has a very, very bipartisan efforts going on right now in both the Senate and the House, and with the President, the administration, to try to deal with this problem that crosses every possible racial, ethnic line, economic line, you name it. It's a huge and growing crisis that we're trying to deal with on a daily basis. So we're trying to bring awareness to all that we're going on. We're trying to get information from stakeholders about that crisis, but also about healthcare delivery in general. So it's not just focusing on, you know, any prior act. It's really trying to figure out how we to better deliver health care to all Americans and give them insurance.
Is part of that, the rural areas, you talk to a lot of these rural leaders, these county commissioners and these mayors, and the hospitals there are in trouble. You're talking about the closing of hospitals, or at least being threatened of closing. You know, And I think some of that has to do with some of the elements of Medicare and these reimbursements. What do you anticipate coming out of this to kind of get something going on that?
Well, the first thing we're doing is just trying to bring awareness to all the problems. People are talking about their health care constantly, and they're concerned about it. So with regard to rural health, it's a really complicated issue. The first thing that I think the biggest problem we have right now is what you alluded to with the wage index and how providers are reimbursed for their services. Alabama is on the very low end of that. We get like 67 cents on the dollar. And the way the system is done, it's just really rigged against Alabama and Tennessee and a couple of other folks. So we continue to stay at the bottom. And the way they reevaluate this, it keeps us at the bottom. We've got to figure out that. I know the Alabama delegation has spent a lot of time working on this over the years. Senator Shelby and I have both talked to Secretary Azar about trying to fix that. That's a big issue. I still believe expansion of Medicaid would be a big economic boon for this state, even though it's a little bit costly. The benefits that come back into the state with the federal dollars and also the jobs that grow with it would be really, really important. We've introduced a couple of bills to maybe give states some incentives again to expand Medicaid. Medicaid props up so much of our rural health care delivery because we are a poor state. And people need that, but it's not just the people on Medicaid. It's the others who depend on hospitals and doctors serving Medicaid patients to also give them the health care delivery that they need.
When you talk to these folks out there, and I know you said there's more to your effort you have underway than just the Affordable Care Act. If there was a way you could tweak the Affordable Care Act, or even if you're hearing from people in the state about the Affordable Care Act, because I know, speaking personally, like my premiums are just outrageous because I buy it from the provider itself, and I think a lot of that has to do with some of the market forces kind of as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Is there any, you know, is there anything that, in your eyes that needs to be done to tweak and make the Affordable Care Act better?
Yeah, well, we're looking at a couple of things, and I know the premiums for people that have especially employer-based programs like that have gone up. Part of the problem is I don't think we have enough market share. We really are not able to have as many choices. And candidly, Jeff, I think that some of the actions that the administration has taken has done things to upset those market forces. That saw rises in premiums more last year than this year. This year has been much more modest increases in the premiums. We need to work on a separate issue that is part of that, but really not included in the original Affordable Care Act, and that is trying to get drug prices under control. That's a huge driver right now to try to figure out working. The president's come up with some ideas. I think the Dr. Gottlieb, who's with FDA, is really doing a wonderful job with thinking outside the box to control that. Congress is looking at trying to rein in some of the drug prices. It's a multi-headed problem that we've got to deal with, and it includes not only the providers, it includes drug prices, it includes insurance companies and what they can offer. Whenever you get, we got to get more people into the healthcare market, the insurance market. The younger healthcare, younger folks need to start buying into their insurance now, which will help the older Americans who do have the health problems and those with pre-existing conditions try to maintain a more stable, affordable healthcare insurance market.
All right, Senator, switching gears here. Last month, you introduced this bill to, I guess it's a civil rights cold case bill. And, you know, what you were known for, at least from my perspective before being a U.S. senator and a candidate, you were U.S. attorney for Bill Clinton for the Northern District of Alabama. And you prosecuted the 16th Street Baptist Church case. And, you know, you brought back these cold cases. And I was just wondering, this legislation you have that you introduced last month, what would it do with these records to bring more sunlight and make them available to the public? What would it do? What purpose would it serve?
Well, one of the things I found in doing those cases is that they're not just the right thing to do, that it was really a healing process for families and the communities in which those atrocities occurred. And unfortunately, so many of those records are kind of shielded from public view because they were criminal cases in the first instance, state, local, or federal. And what we have found is that the more information you can get out by those cases in the past and the things that really tore apart families and communities, The more information you can get, the better. So many of those cases today will never, ever be prosecuted, so you can't rely on the criminal justice system to provide that healing. But by giving historians, the media, and communities, families, and also really, to be honest with you, the families of many of those accused of these crimes, the ability to see and go back and look and see what happened and why things happened, we can learn a lot from that, not to mention the fact just the healing part of this with folks. So this bill will kind of empower the National Archives to bring together these files, to have a commission that will be appointed to oversee releasing those to the community. Obviously, there will be exceptions if any of those cases are still pending and law enforcement thinks they can do something. But it's really one, I'll tell you, Jeff, the most interesting part about introducing that bill to me is when I gave a speech on the Senate floor, Senator Cruz, a Republican from Texas, was sitting in the presiding officer's chair. I noticed during my speech he was paying very, very careful attention. And the next day he told me he was very interested in being a co-lead with me on that bill, and he signed up to do that. We talked about it the other day. He says, I'm really going to work my side of the aisle here because I think we can get this enacted into law. So this is something that cuts across a lot of party lines to do the right thing. So, and I will tell you, I do believe that we as a society can learn lessons from the past so that we don't commit the same kind of mistakes that we made in the past, that we do it in the future again.
When you were a U.S. attorney, were you privy to a lot of these documents or records? And do you have an idea what they involve?
Well, I was privy to those here primarily in the Northern District of Alabama. We had a number of records up here because the FBI kept records on a number of these cases, even though they didn't fully investigate. It's a pretty good bet. I'd say there's probably 100, 125 cases that are still pending out there. And there'll be more records on some than others because so many were state crimes that states just and municipalities just didn't investigate very much. So I don't think it's going to be an enormous task. I don't think it'll cost very much at all to do this. But I have found it is so important to these families who have lived this with us so many years and to the communities in which these crimes occurred.
All right, Senator, I'm going to switch to the Supreme Court nomination. I know you've explained on numerous occasions that you haven't made up your mind and you're not really interested in you know, debating this in the public. But I think one of the interesting things to me is just what the process that you, from your point of view, do you go when any Supreme Court nominee, be it Republican or Democrat, what is the process involved? Do you review their documents? Do you meet with them? What are the things you do to see the whether this nominee is worthy of your vote or not your vote?
Sure. Well, I appreciate you asking a process question because I really believe the Constitution is set up in such a way that the Senate has a shared responsibility with the President for judicial nominations. That's particularly important for Supreme Court. I think my job is to do an independent review. One of the problems in America, I believe we have now, is that everybody goes to their corners and this is a political fight. I see the TV ads and the millions of dollars that are being spent like a political campaign. We're supposed to have an independent judiciary. That's why they're there for life. It's part of our checks and balances. And I think we're in a really bad place when this has become political campaigns. So I'm trying to block those kind of issues out, all of the extraneous stuff, and do my due diligence. So we have been gathering information. Brett Kavanaugh has a large body of work, both as a judge and as a member of the Bush administration. I need to look and see as much as I can on that. We've gotten his opinions, his speeches. We're looking at other records that we'll be getting from the White House. And frankly, I think we may be rushing this a little bit too much because of the significant number of records, but that's not my call. So I'm going to be spending a lot of time with my staff that is working with me, and we've got several people working on this, to try to do a deep dive and to try to review everything he can so that then as I can review that. First of all, as of right now, I plan on waiting to meet with him. I do hope to meet with him. But my view is that I should wait until after the hearing he has his hearing. I don't want my meeting with him or any judge to be a meet and greet and a photo op. It needs to be a substantive meeting on questions that I've found that I want to ask him on a variety of issues. So I'd like to do that because some of them may be covered in the hearing. I may need a follow-up after that. So ideally, I would meet with him afterwards, but we're waiting to see, depending on when that hearing's going to be, because I'd like to be able to have that hearing, meet with him, and then at that point, you know, try to do whatever I need to do to make my decision.
Are you getting any pressure from your own party, not, you know, outside, but just within the body of the Senate on how to handle this? Because you're not at all, because you hear these things and you hear these reports, and you wonder if there's some sort of idea that the Democrats are going to be in lockstep and do one thing and oppose Republicans on all fronts.
Well, you know, that's one way to look at it, but there's just as much pressure with all the Republicans being in lockstep. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, both sides started telling people how they should vote before a nominee was even named. We've had that. I had it here in Alabama that public officials, a couple of them were saying something that I should vote for this nominee regardless of who it might be. So you certainly hear that on the Democratic side, but likewise on the Republican side, you hear people that made up their mind before a nominee was selected, and certainly within hours or minutes after Brett Kavanaugh was named, has already said, yes, this is somebody we got to support. So I don't view my role that way, and I don't succumb to the pressure. I don't feel the pressure. I'm going to, because everybody knows the one thing I think I've established in my caucus as well as Republicans up there is that I'm an independent voice up there, and I'm going to do the right thing. I'm not a rubber stamp for any president, regardless of party, or any party, regardless of where the nominee's coming from.
We got about a minute, a little less than a minute left, and real quick, as a senator, are you a little surprised the way everything you do as a senator is looked at in the prism of what it means to your 2020 reelection bid? That seems to be, you know, you read the political media in a lot of places, that seems to be where a lot of it comes from. Did you anticipate something like this happening?
Unfortunately, I did, because I've just seen how we are, you know, there's such a partisan divide right now. It's the country is so tribal, and that's really unfortunate. So I knew the media would be doing that. But you know what? If I listened to the media and I listened to the pundits, I would have never run for this office. So I just block all that stuff out. I was telling somebody a few moments ago, I'm always asked the questions, particularly by media, how do you navigate? And I don't need to navigate. The only thing I navigate right now is my conscience, and I'm going to do what I believe to be the right thing. And once I make those decisions, then if I can't justify it, whether somebody agrees with me or not, I'm going to be able to justify it, and I will do that after I make those decisions. So we're not doing a navigation. We're not trying to jockey political sides. People are always looking at it through that lens, and I think that that's very unfortunate. I wish more people would be looking at what every senator and every congressional person does with regard to what's the right thing for their district, what's the right thing for the state, what's the right thing for the country.
All right, Senator. Well, thanks for coming on. The Senator Doug Jones from Birmingham. Thanks for coming on.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And it's Jeff Poor back with you, filling in for Sean Sullivan today on FM Talk 106.5. A couple other things to talk about. One of the things, you know, if you watch any of the political media on social media, the big talk is whether or not Kay Ivey will debate Walt Maddox. And that seems to be the most pressing issue of the day. Forget about highway congestion, forget about hospital closures, the starting quarterback for the University of Alabama. It's the most important thing in politics right now is whether we have a gubernatorial debate by Kay Ivey, who looks to me as a, you know, maybe a 40-50 point lead over Walt Maddox, if you believe in the one poll that's out there. But my question is, when in Alabama have we had a media, and this includes AL.com, the Tuscaloosa News, the Montgomery Advertiser, any of these, you know, mainstream outlets you look toward, when have they ever really cared and reflected what the people of Alabama, their sentiments? If you've ever noticed, especially AL.com, they like to approach things from a decidedly Birmingham-centric perspective. They also kind of look at everything from a liberal prism, that we ought to do X, Y, and Z. If you look at their opinion pages, they're filled with the John Archibalds and the Kyle Whitmires, the Roy Johnson, the three big, like, liberal bomb throwers, the cartoonist is J.D. Crow, a Mobilian that I'm sure all these lists, all you know well. But their conservative voices tend to be the never Trump, kind of guys that look at, you know, politics we have to be rational and we have to have a calm discourse. It's David Brooks Light. So my question is, they pretend to tell us, you know, really what is good for us and what they think. Why should we believe that they have a sincere conviction that the best thing for the people of Alabama is to have a debate, have a gubernatorial debate? This is really going to solve a lot of the problems. And I would, you know, add to that, when in Alabama history has a gubernatorial debate ever really influenced votes in this state and swayed a race one way or another? You know, we can go back. I would say maybe Don Siegelman, you know, some of those, and Fob James, when it was really razor thin and close, and then later on with Bob Riley and Don Siegelman. But even then, you wonder if that really had an impact on those races. And this is, we're going back 20 years now. So when you hear these people talk about, we need a debate, we need a debate, we need a debate, I'm really skeptical of that. And when we talk about a debate, what are the issues they're going to talk about? We pretty much know where a lot of these candidates stand on a lot of things. And all Kay Ivey, she has a record, and so does Walt Maddox. I mean, if you haven't been to the city of Tuscaloosa in a while, it's worth a visit. It's really changed from, you know, my younger days. It's nicer. The downtown is really markedly improved, and there's stuff to do. There's something to do in Tuscaloosa besides to go hang out on the strip near the campus. There's more of an adult atmosphere. It's a place you might even want to live, you know, if you live in Tuscaloosa. So, and to his credit, he did a lot after the tornadoes here about 5 years ago and recovering from that situation. But let's go back to it. You know, why would we believe that Walt Maddox is going to be anything to improve upon what Kay Ivey has done? You know, we're coming out as a state of the Robert Bentley fiasco, and a lot of demoralized people in Alabama politics, particularly in Alabama Republican politics. And, you know, let's add to that Senator Doug Jones and Roy Moore. If you're an Alabama Republican, it's been a pretty rough go. You've had Mike Hubbard, you've had Roy Moore, you've had Robert Bentley. Finally, you got a governor in the state, in an overwhelmingly Republican state, that seems to be not really messing up a whole lot. Her biggest thing is she's showing up for ribbon cutting ceremonies all over the state and opening factories and, you know, all these jobs and all these economic activities. She's kind of feeding off the Trump thing with the stock market's roaring and jobs, you know, are you know, the numbers of unemployment are going down and all these metrics we look at to adjudicate the health of the economy. So what is the Democrat perspective, I guess, to where the state could be improved? I know there's a lot of ideas about social welfare programs and the expansion of Medicare, Medicaid, and things like that to improve the health care. And as Senator Doug Jones said in the last segment, you know, he thinks a lot of this would be a big economic boon for Alabama. But I don't know that, you know, do people look at government other than defense spending and maybe some other, you know, government contracts as a way to, you know, stimulate the economy of the state? I don't know. So if I'm a Democrat running in this state right now, all I got is Kay Ivey won't debate me. That's all the message I'm getting. Is that a winning message? Is that a winning message for anybody listening out there? And, you know, feel free to chime in here at 251-343-0106. But I, you know, Kay Ivey, I think, is sailing to re-election right now. She needs some sort of a Roy Moore type scandal, some sort of ethical thing that lapsed that would result in, you know, Walt Maddox even have a shot at it. And at this point in the race, it's hard to see where that might come from. In last year's election, remember when the Washington Post came out with the allegations against Roy Moore, we were about a month out of the election, and the timing of that was really important because it gave the voters enough time to kind of adjust their thoughts. It demoralized some voters that probably would go out for vote for Roy Moore, and it energized a lot of voters, particularly in the Black Belt, to think, hey, we got a shot at this. We could have a Democrat senator for the first time since Richard Shelby, who was once a Democrat, was elected as a Democrat in 1986, beat Jeremiah Denton. We could have a Democrat, and just for that reason, you know, I usually don't go vote, but now that we have some skin in the game and a winning chance, I'm going to go out and vote, and that's that I think had a lot to do with it. And it still took all of these factors coming in together at once for Doug Jones to beat Roy Moore in, you know, in Alabama. How does that, what would that look like at a KIV Walt Maddox race? What planets would have to align for KIV to no longer be the acceptable choice? You saw the, you know, she flexed her muscle in the primary and just, you know, demolished the competition. She had faced three opponents that were well financed, and, you know, I think they got around the state well. They had their pockets of strength, particularly Tommy Battle, the mayor of Huntsville. I would argue everything north of the Tennessee River he had a shot at, and that would have been just enough to keep her under 50% and have a runoff, but it didn't happen, guys. She didn't have to face a runoff. She, she could have, you know, the day of that election primary, I guess Tommy Battle didn't really do a good enough job running up the score in his home turf, getting the voters out, but she, I think, had a lot to do with that. I think she had the message, and, you know, it's me cutting, you know, with a big giant pair of scissors, cutting a ribbon at a new factory. You want more of this? Vote for me. If you want, you know, whatever, if you want to take a chance on one of these guys and you know, go with a different direction, vote for these other guys. But even then, you just, the collective forces of three guys, you didn't really have enough to overcome that. And if she had such a dominant performance in the primary, what reason do we have to believe that she would not have the same dominant performance in a general election in November, particularly when you have this whole national backdrop going on with everybody? I mean, everybody ran as Trump in the Republican primary for a reason, because they look at Trump as the guy they can rally around. He appeals to the Alabama voter. He is the guy that everybody's going to be looking to, and probably a big reason why a lot of people are going to go to the polls in November in this state, even though it's a Republican state. There's not a lot to vote for if you're Republican in a lot of places, because they have such an overwhelming advantage over their Democratic counterparts. But people will see that. They'll think he's getting a raw deal. They'll go out and vote, and they'll vote for the Republican. You know, this trickle-down effect where you have everybody that's on a Republican, people will vote straight Republican. And they're not going to be looking at the gubernatorial race. They may not even know who Walt Maddox is. So what I haven't seen from Walt Maddox is a reason to even win over Republican voters. To be honest, you've got to win over some of these moderate Republicans in some of these places around the state. And you know, we know them. They're the probably the Birmingham suburbs, and maybe some of the Mobile, like the Eastern Shore area. Some people that would be open, not just straight Republican, but would be open to voting for a Democrat if the Democrat was the right Democrat and not a, you know, a left-of-center California or New England-style Democrat. I don't know that we are hearing any of that from the Democratic Party now. The people we have running, you know, you hear Blue Wave, hashtag Blue Wave, and they talk a big game, and it's a lot of it's social media. But when you go to the smaller places, the smaller towns around the state, you don't get any sense of Democratic Party strength. You know, you do in some of the Black Belt region, obviously, because that's the Democrat-leaning parts of the state. But for a Democrat to win in Alabama, you're going to have to pick up votes somewhere else. And I don't know where that's coming from if you're Walt Maddox. This is Jeff Poore in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Let me know what you think. 343-0106.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And it's Jeff Poore back in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Closing out the end of this hour. I want to talk about where I was last night. I went and spent some time in Niceville, Florida for an event for the congressman over there who's running for re-election, Matt Gaetz. I'll probably know him. He's on Fox News a lot, and he's very open about being on Fox News a lot. But what you have going on in the Florida Panhandle, I know the signal gets in over there in Pensacola all the way to Mary Esther, but you have some competitive Republican races. Their primary is until August 28th, so they're kind of going through what Alabama went through about this time a month ago with all the ads. And, you know, Matt Gaetz, I think, is kind of a fan favorite for a lot of Republicans nationally. He's very outspoken about Donald Trump. And since the Pensacola market and the Mobile market overlap, I think he's, you know, you might see a lot of him on your local TV news here. But he's running for re-election, and, you know, there are some Republicans over there, I guess, that aren't really thrilled, you know, having such a guy like a Matt Gaetz out there that's just throwing bombs and, you know, really so steadfastly on board with what President Donald Trump is doing. And the other thing Matt Gaetz, I guess, I think is known for is sort of being the guy that's really questioning the whole deep state thing, the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. that really runs government, that a lot of people think that really runs government, the intelligence agencies and their ability to collect intelligence and do things that, you know, the average citizen can't, and that, you know, may give them some advantage or heads up to advance a political agenda. And I, you know, we could debate Russian interference or not. I think a lot of that is politics and the Democratic Party wanting to distract from a lot of what's going on. But it's interesting to see this play out in Florida, or in the panhandle of Florida, because I think the panhandle of Florida, the politics there, really is a mirror image of what's going on in Mobile. You have some Democrats. You have, you know, for the most part, it's roughly the same mix of Republicans and Democrats. And they're running on the Trump idea just like they were here, at least in that part of the state. Now, you know, other parts of the state, it may be reluctant to run with Donald Trump because he may be seen as sort of an albatross later on in the general elections. Not something you really, you know, you don't want the weight of Donald Trump when you're trying to run as a Republican in a midterm election following a presidential cycle. But in the panhandle of Florida, it's much like it is here. They're running to implement Donald Trump's agenda. They're running to really, you know, push the ball forward and take it and run and with it. And who could be the most Trumpiest? So last night you had Matt Gaetz, and the keynote speaker he had coming last night was Donald Trump Jr., who I with all his controversies and all these other things going on, he's still a very popular draw for the Make America Again Great Again crowd. You also had the guy running for governor over there, Ron DeSantis. He's in a tough primary fight with the agriculture commissioner, Adam Putnam. The two of them, it's been a seesaw battle back and forth. Right now, it looks like as this primary over there is wrapping up, things look to be going DeSantis' way. And DeSantis is the Trump candidate. He is the guy that got the Trump endorsement. So all this momentum is shifting toward people that align themselves with Donald Trump. Does that reflect anything else broader nationally? And I think that's something that's instructive, because can you ever remember a time in our national politics where we've had Republicans so eager to cozy up to the sitting president? And that, I would say, at least in the Republican Party, I can't remember that maybe a little bit after 9/11 with George W. Bush, but that didn't seem to be the thing. That was kind of like, we need to rally together as a nation and wave some American flags and you know, and really consider what's important in life and what isn't. But when we're just looking at the raw politics, Trump is very popular. And I think when we watch the news, if you watch CNN, you watch MSNBC, you think Trump is just the worst president. He, you know, and that has that this is a train headed for disaster. But I think there's something else going on here, and I think that's why these candidates running are so eager to run with Trump. They know something we don't know, you know, we may not necessarily know. And running with the president seems to be a positive. So does that reflect what is to come in the general election cycle when we really start talking about the pros and cons of Donald Trump? And whether or not, I think the big question is, do Republicans keep control of Congress? I think the Senate, probably they do, just given the way the map lines up. There's a lot of Democratic seats up versus Republican seats, so a lot of Democrats are playing defense. Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, you know the names. In Florida, it's Bill Nelson, it's Rick Scott. Rick Scott's very well-funded sitting governor of Florida, running against a long-time incumbent Democrat. People may be getting tired of him. The Republicans may pick up a seat. There's Claire McCaskill in Missouri. There's a lot of these seats all around the country that the Democrat candidate is not as fresh and not as new, so it gives the Republican a shot at it. So I think the Senate may be a little tougher for Democrats to take. The House may be a 50-50 jump ball, but I kind of wonder, now that we're seeing a little bit of a spark, especially with the way people are running over in the panhandle of Florida, and Florida's still a swing state, it still could go either way in a presidential election. The fact that we're seeing statewide candidates run with Donald Trump and are not worried about the repercussions later on down the line in a general election tells me that Donald Trump is not as unpopular as people think he is. I think that he's, you know, he'll definitely be an issue, a campaign issue, but we're going to get to the point where we're not going to discuss the nuance of his policy. We're just going to discuss who could be louder about Trump. And I think if that becomes the prevailing argument, then you could just look at all the things that have happened in the last 2 years under his presidency, and all he's got to say, are you better off now than you were 2 years ago? And let's extend that out to 2020. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I think it makes it very tough for Democrats to overcome that if we're just going to go head-to-head, who's got the loudest voice and who could get their voters out. If you're really trying to peel off that middle and get that center vote, that's the question that's going to be asked. How are you faring under a Trump presidency? This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan today. Let us know what you think. 251-343-0106.